there it goes.
All right, do you want to start with your concluding remarks again?
Okay. So in conclusion, I think there are three key issues that I think are important to understand as this plan is reviewed. First is the timing of development. This plan is based on a 10-year conceptual plan that reflects the university's anticipated needs in 2028. However, as was the case with the 2003 plan, this plan will stay in effect until the growth allowance is used up. If the university receives funding, it is possible that the growth allowance will be constructed in 10 years, but it is also possible that the growth allowance will not be completely used up by 2028. The development of the campus under the 2003 CMP highlights this point. The current CMP, which is the 2003 one, has a growth allowance of 3 million square feet. That growth allowance took us 15 years to complete. We will hopefully finish building that out in 2018, but again, it'll take us 15 years to get there. So in the 2003 plan, on page 151, it actually says, based on analysis of past development trends, needs, and funding sources, it is anticipated that during the life of this plan, the university will build an average 600,000 gross square feet of net new buildings annually, for a total development of 6 million gross square feet over the life of the 2018 plan. However, there may be some years where development is more or less than the 600,000 net new gross square feet. So that's what it says in the 2018 plan. That's how we look at development over a certain amount of time. But in the 2003 plan, it anticipated that the build-out rate would be 300,000 gross square feet per year. But based on the fact that it took 15 years to complete, the average, obviously, was actually 200,000. So that lag was due to availability of funding sources. So again, we're planning for a 2018 timeframe, but funding will definitely impact. The second issue that I think we need to look at is the TMP SOV rate goal versus the conservative consumptions and a transportation analysis. As discussed by our transportation consultants, the transportation projections in the FEIS were based on a very conservative 20% SOV rate goal. The analysis was also conservative, because we are not going to be building out 6 million gross square feet on day one, as some of the exhibits assume. Yet even though a 20% SOV rate was assumed for the purposes of a conservative analysis, it is clear from the plan that the TMP goal is 15%, not 20%. And the third issue is the distinction between the long-term vision versus the 10-year conceptual plan. Both Ms. Clausen and Ms. Barnes covered this, but it cannot be emphasized enough that the capacity we have identified for the long-term vision, or build-out, which is based on our current assumptions, is close to double what we were asking for in our growth allowance. The long-term vision for campus will therefore not be realized by this plan alone. Future plans will be required to fully build out the campus. I think the best example of this is the East Campus concept between the long-term vision and the 10-year conceptual plan. If you actually turn to page 210 of the 2018 Campus Master Plan, and you look at page 210 and 211, you will see that on page 210, it illustrates the 10-year conceptual plan, which shows 750,000 of development in the area of the East Campus. And that 750,000, this is an illustrative of the buildings that could add up to 750,000 square feet. They're in the kind of the pinky purple color. And then you turn and look at the next page, page 211, and you will see that there are 29 development sites in East Campus. And if you added up the capacity of those 29 development sites, it would come to 4.6 million square feet, a little bit over 4.6 million. So again, what we're trying to say here is the long-term vision or long-term capacity is 4.6 million. The 10-year conceptual plan is talking about 750. And that's a similar concept in each of the other sectors of campus. The division of growth allowance identified in the 10-year conceptual plan into the four sectors with maximum development limits is also an important component of the plan. This approach is the same one that we took in 2003, and it allows for the kind of flexibility the university needs to respond to departmental growth. By identifying twice as many sites as needed, the university planners can work with departments to meet their needs. Maybe their need is proximity to their current building, or maybe it is the need to be in the West Campus where innovation, inclusive innovation is going to be occurring. Or it may be that they want to be in South Campus next to their health sciences partners or by the medical center. Our planners need the flexibility to locate new buildings where they are needed most, and we believe that this plan allows for that. So lastly, I'd just like to say that we worked very hard to review the comments as they came in, whether they came from the city, the CUCAC, or broader community. We tried very hard to understand what the issue or issues were, and then worked even harder to balance the concerns with our ability to balance their concerns with our ability to meet our mission. We believe that we did a good job in balancing these needs based on our mission and funding constraints. And we hope that you will recommend approval of the plan. Thank you.
Any questions, Mr. Nguyen?
Just a couple. Thank you, Ms. Doherty. When speaking about the SDCI conditions 17 and 18, these are about moving development around the campus. You mentioned that there's language in there that came from the council, correct?
Yes.
Are you aware of any document that explains why the council included that?
Can you give me one of the, can I see the actual Appendix A? I don't have that in front of me. Okay, which ones are we referring to again? 17 and 18?
17 and 18.
SDCI conditions, 17 and 18.
They're in the current, I want to say the current ordinance. I believe there is, in one of these two conditions, it's actually in the current ordinance, I believe. I'm not sure what page. Okay. That's what I thought. The current ordinance. Ordinance 121041.
Thank you for the assist, Council. do you know whether that ordinance explains why that language was added in?
I don't know if I have that information in front of me. No, I don't have that information in front of me.
And you're not aware of, I mean, sitting here today, which is
sitting here right
asked, you're not aware of any other document that explains the Council's rationale for adding that?
I don't have that information in front of me right now.
That's fair. Thank you. One other thing, and perhaps I should work it out with Council, but you said future speakers are going to identify the affordable housing and transportation.
Mm-hmm.
Do you mean to refer to speakers who've already spoken? Or?
No. Well, we have...
Well, you let the witness answer.
Sorry. Well, we have Sally, Ms. Clark is going to speak about affordable housing.
Thank you.
And transportation, I believe, as well.
Okay. Thank you. I was... confused. That's all I have. Thank you.
Anything further?
Nothing further.
Thank you.
Speaking of Sally Clark, our next witness.
Sad that Roger forgot about me.
It's grateful you got the memo about the green sweater day.
You know, that's strange. Oh, you're colorblind. I did not know that about you.
Could you raise your right
hand? Yes, ma'am.
Do you swear or affirm that the testimony you will give in this proceeding will be the truth?
I do.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Good morning, Ms. Clark. Would you please introduce yourself?
Hello, my name is Sally Clark. I am the University of Washington's Director of what's called the Office of Regional and Community Relations. We work to ensure that UW is the best neighbor it can be, and that decision makers in the area have information that they need regarding UW's academics, research, and patient care. We also work to make sure that students, staff, and faculty get any help they need making connections around campus and in the region. Because the students and faculty and staff are so entwined in the city and in the region, I get to be involved in a range of projects, and that is, I think, the basic reason that we're here to talk about some of those initiatives today that you've heard about already. I also co-staff CUCAC with Maureen Sheehan, who was here on Friday from the Department of Neighborhoods, and we'll talk about CUCAC in a little bit as well. I'll note that so far I think I'm the only speaker who's a triple dog, and the people and connections that I made at the University of Washington are really why I live in Seattle. They're certainly why I came to Seattle originally, and they're why I stayed. Prior to this, I served as a Seattle City Council member. I was appointed in 2006 and ran citywide three times after that, and I served as the council's land use committee chair for 4 years.
Thank you. I will say, as a double dog, I'm jealous of you.
Yep.
What's your name,
Constantine?
What's your role here today?
Yeah, my role here today is I hope to go slightly deeper into detail on a couple of areas. Those couple of areas include UW initiatives that are actually outside of the master plan but that address priorities brought up by CUCAC, public comment, and by the city. It's important, I think, to remember the context here, and we've talked a little bit around the edges of this, but the master plan does not encompass all university initiatives and commitments, nor is it required to do so. This document is supposed to be a site plan, identifying potential development sites and setting out the guidelines, rules, and regulations that will govern development. The required contents of the master plan are set forth in the City-University Agreement. So I think part of what I want to talk about here is that just because the subject is not addressed in the master plan does not mean that it is not a priority for the university and referenced in other plans and initiatives. Specifically, I think we've heard a little bit, even though social justice issues like affordable housing we believe are outside the scope of the master plan, we are mindful that this is the record that will be considered by others, including the City Council. So we want to make sure that we correct any oversights or mischaracterizations from previous speakers. And I'll include Sharon Lee, who spoke on Friday. Sharon is a great advocate. I want to be very clear about that up front. She is nonstop when it comes to solving homelessness, and we had a great chance to talk after her testimony, but she wasn't quite up to speed on some of UW's current initiatives. I'm going to grab water from time to time here. I am fighting off a cold. My household has been head cold central, and so far I've survived it, but I'm not sure how the rest of this week will go.
While you take that sip, I'll ask the first topic then to address is, in fact, affordable housing.
Yeah, good. You know, just from the top, the principle of housing affordability and commute distances are of a concern for the university when it comes to recruitment and retention at all levels within the university. The greatest concern, though, as I have been at the university for the past couple of years and working on this particular project, this particular initiative that I'll talk about in a moment, the concern by the current president and the provost is greatest for lower-wage staff and faculty within the university because they frankly, I think we know, have just less flexibility and fewer choices in this region. Over the past few years, I've had a chance to connect with this work in the University of Washington, and there are staff that I've been a part of this group where we have connected with a group called the Academic Housing Association. This is a group that comprises a wide range of schools, both public and private. They get together sometimes annually, it tends to be a little less than annually, to share best practices. And the best practices have been really helpful for us to learn about. It's also been helpful to note that not all of them are applicable in Seattle and not all are applicable for public institutions. Sharon noted in her testimony on Friday particularly that Harvard has invested in housing for staff and faculty, and I will acknowledge that our review of peer institutions has not gone deep into the Harvard example. We did look, though, at Columbia, Stanford, and USC. All of those have affiliated real estate entities that produce housing less than market rate for rent or for purchase. I should note that those are the private universities that we've looked at, and I really would love to have the kind of flexibility and the endowment flexibility that those institutions have. What we did look at in terms of peer institutions, we looked at Berkeley, UCLA, Iowa, and Michigan. All of them provide some access to rental housing on a competitive basis and some form of down payment help for purchasers of housing in their regions. These are all public universities, and therefore we think they more closely align with what we can do and what we can offer. Some of their state regulations are a little bit different, again, regarding gift of public funds, things of that nature. The fact is that we'd like to do better than those institutions because, again, we compete for talent, particularly at the faculty level, and we have to compete in terms of our own region here and other employers. We are actively reviewing a range of options for pros and cons, best impact for staff and faculty, impacts on university debt, and any implications for the university as a state agency with responsibility to use the university's property in support of the university's mission. Responding to the need for affordable housing is not a single point in time effort. There is not going to be a single fix for anybody in this region regarding housing affordability. UW is not alone in that. There won't be a single solution. So I'll go through a couple of things that we do now. I'll start with relatively minor, moving up to the new initiative that we've announced recently. So visiting faculty housing services. Some people ask, well, what about folks who are visiting for short-term placements? We do a listing service to match new and visiting UW faculty and staff with rental housing in the region. That program helped approximately 100 visiting faculty and staff find housing last year. Moving on to the Hometown Home Loan Program, this is through Home Street Bank. It's very similar to what the City of Seattle provides to employees as well. This is operated with UW since 1999, and it is the program that provides reduced fees and costs on both new purchases and refinances. There have been 3,236 total loans to UW staff and faculty via Hometown Home Loan, and 1,282 of those were first-time home buyers. Another initiative that the UW has been involved in, it opened in 2015. It's called Bridges at 11th. This is the kind of more recent foray into actual development and control of income-controlled units. This is an arrangement with Children's Hospital, and some might recall they had to do some housing replacement as a result of their expansion. The deal was UW land lease. Children's gets involved with a subsidy contribution. It's multifamily tax exemption through the city. Children's was actually displacing housing in that example. It has 184 total units, 37 of which are income restricted to people making 65% to 85% of the area median income, and that's $41,000 to $82,000 depending on family size. All of those figures are in the campus master plan, and I think it's page 276 according to my notes. Best priority access, again, for UW and Children's employees, and that means that we market the heck out of it to UW employees who would be income qualified. Folks who have been there that I've been aware of, we've checked in on this from time to time, folks from UW Medical Center, folks from main campus, and again, they're kind of in those jobs that match up with those income levels. The newest effort, there was earlier testimony, I think Sharon had actually said this, that UW should use university property for mixed-income housing. That sounded vaguely familiar because we had just announced a couple of months ago, actually, that that's exactly what we're doing. So we have a memorandum of understanding with Seattle Housing Authority, and that will involve the use of university property. It's actually outside the MIO. It's at 41st and Roosevelt. It's approximately 22,000 square feet. The university's goal for this with Seattle Housing Authority's help will be affordable housing for lower-wage staff and faculty. That, for us, would be the target is a 60% AMI cap for those units. We'd also like to see some units for formerly homeless young people, and we want to see child care in the project. That will all be rolled into an RFP that will go out in the first quarter of 2018. We've talked about this as 150 units, and that's had some people chatting. That's what's most likely. The property is actually zoned for hire, so we've tried to be conservative and recognize what a lot of projects come in at, which is the 5-over-2 type development. The City of Seattle is excited about seeing larger projects, and that's possible at this site. We've just tried to be conservative and pragmatic in how we've talked about it. It's zoned for 240, so it could certainly go much higher than the 150 unit. Just depends on the responses to the RFP and the funding that's available for that development. While we'd be precluded from discriminating based on employer, we can't just require that it's all UW people. Our intention, again, is to market the heck out of this through affirmative information out to UW staff and faculty who would be income qualified to take advantage of this. It'll be a project that we know will be high quality because we get to say yes or no on the RFP. It's near campus. It's near light rail. And so we're excited about this project.
I've got a exhibit I want to refer to. It's Exhibit D14. It is a press release. And I just want to confirm that's the press release that refers to the project you just described. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yep.
Let's move on to the topic of homeless youth. That was another issue that came up in comments on Friday.
It did. This is another one where it was great to be able to talk to Sharon after testimony and bring her up to speed on a couple of projects. In particular, well, I guess I'm going to step back, and this is another one where I've learned a lot in my short time at the university about the different ways that UW faculty, students, and staff are part of virtually every effort that's underway in this area to end youth homelessness in this neighborhood, region, state, and to assist those who are struggling now in the university district neighborhood. These efforts include everything, research, service, legal clinics, a particular project called U-District Street Medicine, technical assistance to nonprofits that are working in this region so that they can do even more excellent work, social work, school of social work practicums, and then you heard Professor Way testify earlier about Urban at UW's work in this area, and that's been a unifying program to bring faculty together so that they can collaborate more effectively. Recently, with help from House Speaker Frank Chop, UW has launched with community partners a new project, and this is called the Doorway Project. Doorway Project is led by Professor Josephine Ensign in UW's School of Nursing, and it's predicated on a community cafe model that she and others have researched both in Europe and in New Zealand, actually. It's in partnership with Youth Care, and we're working also with the Roots Young Adult Shelter in the University District. And the idea is to reach homeless young people in the U-District who, for whatever reason, haven't connected successfully with services. And there are plenty of them. The idea is that through quarterly pop-up service events through this whole year, this whole academic year, those locations will move around the University District. And we will try to involve and attract homeless young people to these pop-up service events and try to crack the code on what is it that has kept them from being connected to services? What is it that has kept them out? Is it a job? Is it treatment? And is it getting back to school? And figure out how to help them take the next step towards getting back on track. We had the first one earlier this month. It was in the parking lot at University Heights, and we are planning the next one for February, and the location for that is still pending.
Thank you. Also want to then shift gears to child care. We heard a little bit of discussion earlier today about CUCAC's recommendations 8 and 9.
Child care is another one where it is both a business and I guess, I mean, you heard Ms. Sanchez talk earlier today. It's a human imperative, and the University of Washington is deeply committed to figuring out how we provide more child care. We compete for talent, and that is at the student level, staff, faculty level, and that the combination of a lack of capacity citywide and high costs is a real challenge for all institutions, and the university is struggling in the same way. So we currently serve more than 400 children in child care centers on or near campus. President Calcedo has made a public goal that is easily found and has been repeated to double our child care capacity on or near campus over the next 5 to 8 years. The Child Care Advisory Group, that's made up of students, staff, and faculty, that meets quarterly to receive updates and to continue to measure our success in meeting that goal over time. It's about, again, increasing access overall through both the number of slots and the affordability of those slots. There is some assistance that's currently available. Some assistance is available to students via the Child Care Assistance Program that's funded by student fees, and it covers kids birth to 12 years old. There is some limited child care assistance that is provided via a couple of the labor contracts, the United Auto Workers grad students, and also medical residents. They receive a modest amount to offset costs. Two child care support funds have been set up at the university for folks who want to pay it forward. That can be through combined giving, and it can be designated funds as well. And then UW did make a commitment, and I think we've been waiting on this one. UW made a commitment to participate in what at the time was called the Large Employer Working Group, and that was specified in the U District rezone. And honestly, I think both the university and SEIU 925 are eagerly waiting to find out if the new mayor's staff is going to pick up that effort as it was undertaken by a previous mayor. And we're waiting to see if that can get jump-started. In addition, UW also offers staff and faculty priority access and a 10% discount at several of the off-campus child care centers, including the Bright Horizons Network. Within the primary and secondary area zones, there are 548 slots at 9 centers. And priority access is also provided at locations outside the immediate vicinity of the Seattle campus. That's probably better addressed in the key topic. Child care is a key topic in the final EIS, and I think that's, if my notes are correct, volume 2, pages 4 through 42.
And all of these initiatives that you've talked about and the intentions that you've expressed, these are happening without regard to the master plan.
These have to happen without regard to the master plan. These are about the ongoing function and success of the university, both in its mission and frankly, as an employer.
And in terms of resource commitments to these, in these particular areas of social justice, we heard commentary that the university, again, is a large corporation with unlimited resources and enjoys an exemption from property taxes. Could you comment on those points a little bit?
I was about to make a flip statement about enjoying exemption from property taxes. The institution is a state agency. It's a public entity, and that means it's like others. So it's like the city of Seattle. It is like Seattle Schools. It is like SDCI. Funding from every UW initiative comes from the three sources, and I think Teresa got into this a little bit in her testimony as well. The three sources, taxpayers, students and their families, and then private philanthropy. So for taxpayers, legislative appropriations and federal grants. Students and their families, tuition and fees. Private philanthropy, grants and gifts. And I would love to say that those come all unrestricted and that there's maximum flexibility. Almost all those gifts are restricted. People give because they connect with a part of the mission, not because we can go to them and say they're an ATL. We can't borrow without legislative authority. Mr. Roach testified on Friday and commented that some of the state agencies have been provided a free UPass option for their employees. The legislature did fund that for other agencies, and we have inquired about that, and it's on our list of things that we would love to see happen, but the UW was not included in that funding package. That is another example of how UW is not like a large corporation with unlimited resources. So these affordability concerns in Seattle bring up all sorts of questions about these kinds of exemptions and shifts, and I don't, as a citizen, I don't anticipate that those will subside anytime soon. But I do hope that people will consider that this policy regarding property taxes, that decision was made long ago and was with regard to the public benefit of public education, research, and patient care. UW, Seattle Public Schools, Seattle Colleges, all are exempt. This approach helps make it possible things like the Husky Promise, the free tuition program that President Cousey spoke about, and last year's $360 million in uncompensated care. It all adds up to the mission. The coming year will see new attacks on higher education from Congress. We know that. We see that coming. It would be unfortunate for us locally to feed into that narrative that somehow higher education is no longer a valuable pathway to better jobs, better citizenry, and healthier communities.
And you said earlier you were involved, you co-staffed CUCAC. Can you talk a little bit about the process
of CUCAC? Yeah, finally, I took over that role when I started at the university, and so CUCAC is staffed in tandem. I should say, honestly, it's mostly staffed by Maureen Sheehan, but it is a joint job by the university and the Department of Neighborhoods. CUCAC, of course, is not mandated by the City University Agreement. It is evergreen. That's a little bit different from the other community advisory committees. It meets monthly and it meets year-round, and I can tell you the group does not like to cancel meetings. They do not. There can be a very minimal agenda. They want to meet. They want to talk about what's going on. They do not like to be left without a monthly meeting. When I started about 2.5 years ago, Teresa and I both went around. We connected with every member of neighborhood organization for CUCAC, including Ravenna Springs, which had dropped out of existence for a little while but came back this year. That was an opportunity for me to introduce myself, but it was also an opportunity for us to flag for them the campus master plan process is starting up. It's the university's desire that there be a full complement around the table so that there can be full and robust conversations. So we did our best to make sure that we could get complete participation, and we actually got pretty close. I mean, I think we had almost everybody at the table all the time, with some folks coming in and out a bit. Those meetings are managed by the CUCAC co-chairs, so Maureen and I are off to the side, and it's Mr. Fox and Mr. Gaines who are managing those meetings on a monthly basis. It is not a shy group. You could tell that from their testimony as well. A handful of them are veterans from the 2003 plan as well. This is not their first rodeo. The basics of how the campus master plan went through the CUCAC review, staff began by reviewing the terms of the city-university agreement. And for CUCAC's review of the draft plan and the EIS, and then the review of the final plan and the EIS, all of that going back and forth and looking at the different versions, the university paid for a professional facilitator to assist the group with organizing the review and their input in order to help assure that everybody had a chance to share their view and input so that the co-chairs wouldn't feel like they were both managing the meeting and trying to participate in the conversation on behalf of their neighborhood group. The university, I can attest, has listened carefully to that input, has considered all of that input, and has identified places where CUCAC's input changed the final from the draft, and there was a presentation on that last May to CUCAC as well. In the end, the university did accept many of CUCAC's recommendations, but obviously not all of them, and you've heard a number of folks speak about that, and I think we've tried to explain the reasons why some of those have not been accepted. I know from my past work, and I think, Madam Examiner, you know, that citizen engagement in land use is challenging for a variety of reasons. UW's public participation plan anticipated that challenge, or at least tried to, and tried to create ample opportunities for early and meaningful participation. That included online comment forums, in-person open houses, everything around and in between. And I want to say, finally, CUCAC members did an enormous amount of work over the past 2 years, and I really respect the attention and diligence that they paid. They gave meaningful direction that is reflected in this plan and in the conditions that are being considered now. And I and UW are grateful for their service. That's all I have laid out.
Anything, Mr. Wynn?
I have no questions.
Thank you, Ms. Clark.
Thank you very much.
So the only witness we have left is Professor Lazowska, who's not available till tomorrow morning.
Okay. And so we should go to lunch, and we'll go early, still be back at 1:30 because that's when public testimony is scheduled, and we'll start with Mr. Wynn's case. All right? Thank you.